This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer Squad, and unfortunately, all we can talk about is long-term care and the deadly trajectory that we are on. Let me focus a moment on one long-term care operator here in Ontario. As you heard in Jeremy's news, seven residents have died at a Scarborough, Ontario long-term care home, the Rockcliffe Care Community, while 136 other residents, that's 136 out of 204, and 66 staff members have tested positive. It's owned by Sienna Senior Living, and if that name sounds familiar, it's because this company owns five of the 20 homes that were hardest hit during the first wave. It had the highest numbers of deaths in the first wave, and three of its homes were taken over by the province in the first wave. It also is the subject of three class action suits. So what does it take to be sanctioned as a bad actor? I am asking that question. As you also heard in Jeremy's news, 107 long-term care homes in total are in outbreak in this province. And there's even a possibility that our government will be investigated for violating the human rights of people in long-term care. That's what happened in Belgium. 61% of their deaths in the first wave were in long-term care. Here, it was 80%. So who knows where this is going? And I think the big question is there anything we can still do to avoid this headlong drive to disaster? And what of the campaign to fire Merrily Fullerton? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. I'd like to bring in our Zoomer Squad, David Kravit, Vice President of Zoomer Media and Chief Marketing Officer at CARP, Bill Van Gorder, Interim Chief Policy Officer at CARP, and Peter Mugridge, Senior Editor of Zoomer Magazine. Hey, guys, how are you?
Hello, Libby.
Good morning, Libby.
Okay, let us start with Bill. Bill, how is the campaign going?
The campaign is going well, I'm sorry to say. I'm sorry to say because we shouldn't even have to have this campaign. We have over 800 signatures to the petition already, and it's only been going a few days. We're getting literally scores and scores of very strong comments, both on the petition and on our Facebook page. And we're getting everything that I guess we hoped we would get, except no reaction from the government at all.
Interesting. David, where do you think we're at? I mean, one of the things I'm trying to wrap my head around, we knew this was coming. We heard the premier so many times and speaking from the heart. He was going to do everything. And now it's back. It's deja vu all over again.
I think the premier has been trapped, if I may say so, between two worlds, one which is quite reasonable and one which is a kind of emergency situation that hasn't been responded to that way. So when the, if you can remind our listeners and our own team here, because we've talked about it every week, when this first hit, we said, oh my God, this has revealed years of neglect predating Ford. The homes were in no position to deal with this. There were staff levels. The inspections were loose. There's all kinds of problems. And those problems will require time and money to fix. So nobody was saying you can wave your magic wand and create a couple hundred new buildings that, or refurbish the buildings that are there. Everything took time. And those plans are quite reasonable. and they've been announced, and they all make sense. The trouble is the house is on fire, and we need Band-Aids. We need emergency action that might not be sustainable and might not be typical of what the long-term solution would be. By contrast, in Quebec last summer, the premier faced with the scandalous, even much worse than Ontario, outbreaks in their homes, launched an emergency plan to hire 10,000 workers. There was going to be a crash course, I think 60 or 90 days of training. They had 55,000 applicants for those positions. So they were taking some unusual steps in the face of a horrendous, equally horrendous record in their own province, and we've seen no equivalent here, and I think that's where the problem is.
Well, yeah, and I think one of the keys with that move in Quebec, in addition to promising a very good wage for those jobs, they called them something other than personal support workers. They called them orderlies. They paid for the training, which is a barrier, and they did it so that these people were in place. And when I look at this, I think, well, it's too late for that. And the province has some plan for assistance. Is people who lost their jobs in hospitality to work in long-term care, really, they're going to want to do that? And they don't know anything about how to handle the very compromised residents. Peter, what do you think?
Well, you know, Libby, I think the key with the Quebec strategy, which you mentioned, is money. You know, they're paying for the training and they're offering more money, and that will turn out bodies, you know. Just saying, you know, we support our frontline workers and sort of hoping that people will respond out of a sense of duty, it's probably not going to happen unless you put some money on the table. And, there is money on the table, but I don't know what it's being used for right now. It seems to be more long-term rather than short-term emergency hiring.
Well, yeah, and, you know, it's almost hard to keep track of the vicissitudes, but there was a special pandemic pay. I think it's not in force anymore. I'm not sure about that, you know, of an extra $3 or $4 an hour. And yes, they finally moved to prohibit people from working in more than one home. But we see this situation where these workers don't even have benefits. I mean, And there was time to do this. I'm sorry, there was time to do this. So, just trying to be a little constructive here, what do you think we could do now, Bill? I mean,
And by the way, not only was there their time, but even in their plans now that were announced for improving staffing, they're talking about 2024, 2025.
Yeah.
So that and there's no plan in place. I know you spoke to the minister, the finance minister.
Oh, the finance minister.
And he said they hadn't had time yet to put together a plan and a budget. Well, there is no time. This is an emergency, and they've had 8 months to do it. The other thing, though, is that it's really hard to see how they can stop the COVID from getting into long-term care homes when they aren't able to smother the flare-ups that are in the city right now. That unless we're able to control all of it, long-term care homes are going to be the first and the worst to be hit. Remember, we still have double and triple rooms in many of these older facilities. We know more about COVID now, but we're not doing anything to change the conditions that were there 8 months ago.
Well, exactly. And I'm kind of curious. We've seen this report from Amnesty International in Belgium, and they are citing Belgium for violating the human rights of residents of nursing homes. And one of the keys there is that they were not allowed to go to hospitals to be treated. And they're saying because of that, a lot of them died prematurely. And we saw much of the same here. It was a real patchwork. People from some places were sent to hospital. Others, again, they were not allowed to go to the hospitals. They died in their nursing homes. Is that something that is on your radar, David?
Well, it's very much, because I'm thinking back to the Royal Society report, which we discussed several weeks ago, about the reason that the problem existed in the first place was sort of an unspoken ageism on the part of the policymakers. And that does speak to issues of human rights and not just situational, maladministration or incompetence, which is very serious, but not necessarily, affecting deliberately infringing on human rights. But if there is ageism, if there is this kind of attitude, and bear in mind that the nursing home population without COVID is older, averaging in the 80s. Most of them have comorbidities. So they are a population that does not have, under the best of circumstances, a long lifespan ahead of them. And it's all too easy to say, well, if this doesn't get them, something else will. Maybe you don't put that in writing, but maybe that's your underlying attitude. And it is a very serious issue of ageism and of how we treat older people who are at risk and are all too readily abandoned, it seems, by the system.
Bill, interesting. The other thing that's happening is that we have healthcare professionals campaigning for much stricter measures, because one of the things that the authorities cite, partly when they're kind of rationalizing what's going on, they say that the virus is in the community, and frankly, it's in the community in much higher numbers than it was in the first wave. But that maritime lockdown that we all looked upon with horror, it's working pretty well.
Well, although the cases are increasing and community spread is back in many provinces across the country, including in Atlantic Canada, where they have the bubble that was supposed to control that. And the problem is that although we know more about what's happening and what we might do to control it, the resources and the focus isn't being put on doing that. And it's the old saying, expecting things to be different when we don't make any changes. And that's what's happening right now. The whole lack of even, and there's no national standards, no accountability. Everything is fragmented, not focused. The situation is getting worse, not better.
I thought there were just like a very, very tiny number of cases in the Maritimes now. Am I wrong?
Well, they're tiny comparatively, but as a percentage of population and of growth in terms of community spread, there's where there were none a couple of weeks ago, we're now getting up into the dozens, and more coming all the time. And the really scary thing is the community spread. That's what was controlled before. The only time we were seeing any kind of infections being passed on was when somebody traveled from outside of the bubble, brought it back, and then people close to them got COVID. Now we're finding it increasing in clubs, in bars, in grocery stores, in pet stores, in restaurants, and that wasn't happening before. So there's a real fear among people in especially in the long-term care area in Atlantic Canada, and now that the high dose flu vaccine has run out and it's not even available anymore. People are being extremely worried that we're going to have that twindemic that we were talking about 4 or 5 months ago.
Okay, well, on the subject of that, people, take whatever vaccine is available. Don't not get a vaccine because the high dose isn't available. So we're seeing this community spread. And it's really alarming. Peter, I mean, in terms of long-term care, how do you see things?
Well, we have a friend who is a PSW at a big Toronto long-term care home, and she got it. And so she was out for 2 weeks, and, you know, a number of other staff along with her got it. So that home, which already had a staffing problem, is now, you know, completely undermanned because a number of frontline workers have gone down with COVID. And, like, in 2 weeks they'll be back, but that 2 weeks, how are they going to cope, you know? And I'm sure that situation is repeating itself across the province, you know.
Right, remember, people are being told that even if you have a sniffle or a headache or anything, don't go to work.
Right, and which is probably a good thing, but it also takes a very important worker out of the front line and with no replacement.
Yeah, well,
Peter is right. And what we're also hearing is that they don't have the PPE that they want to have and expected to have, and that was promised. And we hear the government trumpeting about all the extra PPE that's available, but then we're hearing directly from long-term care workers that they're limited to one N95 mask a day. They have to take that mask off four or five times a day, naturally, as they have their breaks and have other reasons they have to take the mask off. So they're touching it. Every time they take it off, they're at risk of spreading even further. So that the claim that there's now enough PPE is not holding true. And the increase in incidences of COVID being in the long-term care facilities really seems to bear that out. The protection is not there for the workers. And if it's not there for the workers, it certainly isn't there for the residents.
Okay. You mentioned a national standard. Last week, Premier Ford of Ontario delivered, I heard it as a warning to the Prime Minister, basically said, stay in your lane or there will be trouble, which means don't encroach on any kind of provincial jurisdiction, which is health, but you can send money. Money would be good.
Yeah. Yeah. Money's always good.
And you send it quicker than you've been sending it.
Unfortunately, what we've found through this whole process is that politics will not solve the issues of COVID. It's got to be medical decisions that are based on the data and the facts that we have. And what we're finding more and more in Ontario and across the country is that politicians are not following the medical advice. They're making decisions based on other criteria, other opinions, and sometimes a question of exactly what they're basing it on. And we have, if we had followed the good advice of the healthcare experts right from the beginning, we wouldn't be in the place we are today.
Right. Right. That's not necessarily comforting. So where do we go from here, David?
Well, I think one of the things we have to get really clear in looking at the long-term care homes, particularly in the Ministry of Long-Term Care. And one of the reasons CARP is so furious and so many of our respondents are so furious is Ontario is the only province that has a Ministry of Long-Term Care. So your first response would say, well, that's pretty innovative. They set that up in 2003 around the time of SARS. Somebody recognized that long-term care was a big enough component of the healthcare system to warrant its own bureaucracy, if you will, and they spun it off as a completely separate ministry a little over a year ago. And I think Marilee Fullerton was the first minister only with that portfolio. So you got one job. We're not blaming them for why did COVID exist. We're not blaming them for should you wear masks or not, should you close restaurants and gyms or not, where's the vaccine coming from, what's the latest medical read. That's all somewhere else. All we're saying is you had one thing to worry about, 600 and some odd buildings under your watch. You had a lull in the case rate and the fatality rate as the first wave faded. You had a shocking example of what can happen when things go wrong. You had all these months to worry about your one responsibility. And here we are. And that's why everybody said, well, I don't blame the Marilyn Fullerton or Doug Ford or the ministries. There's a host of issues relating to COVID that has nothing to do with them that they cannot be held accountable for. But it's reasonable to hold them accountable for the one topic that should have been their concern all along and that they've been dithering around with. And I think that's why there's so much anger at the mismanagement of this.
Yeah,
and why we want to keep the pressure on them.
The question I have is, you know, how much agency did they even have in this, right? I mean, how much authority did they even have? And you know, since everything comes down to money, how much money did they have to fix things with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's my question. I mean,
well
we don't even know if they had any authority to do anything.
Part of it is lack of systems that are working. The Canadian Medical Association said very clearly that if governments protected frontline workers and protected the residents, therefore, from frontline workers bringing the COVID into their residents, that would go a tremendous way in terms of stopping COVID. And we were told that the PPE was there to protect frontline workers, the testing was there to do it, but it wasn't done. They didn't follow through, and now that's what we're seeing. Now we're having the medical experts across the country talk about a new thing, which is a circuit breaker. In other words, to set a time, whether it's 2 weeks or 4 weeks, and say we're going to shut down everything in our province for this amount of time and just do it. That way, business and others could plan. If you know it's going to be 2 weeks, you could plan how long you're not going to be doing business and work with it. But the circuit breaker idea is gaining great traction among the experts recommending, and governments are staying away from it politically. At some point, they've got to start listening to the good advice of the people who know what they're talking about.
And coming up later in the show, Bill, thanks for helping me with a promo there. We're going to be talking to experts who actually think a circuit breaker won't be enough. And they think we have to get very, very serious and very aggressive about this. But people, you have to hang on for that. So as we can see, there are all these competing ideas of how to keep things in check. And I'm saying keep things in check. They actually aren't in check. So the genie is out of the bottle. And what do we have to do to get it to go back in is very difficult. I mean, Peter, you know, people talk about businesses and the damage to the economy and the damage to mental health when people are locked down. How do you see that tension?
Well, you know, the first lockdown was punishing enough on people and on businesses. And, you know, everyone was a bit chuffed in the summer to come back to work and, you know, open up the restaurants and bars and gyms. And this second one is going to have a tremendously negative effect on them. Just when they thought things were turning around and they could open with restrictions, now it looks like more and more that it's going to be full closure coming up. You know, and it's not only I don't want to say a death blow, but it's certainly a real hard kick financially coming up, but also mentally. Like, these people, their whole lives went into these businesses, and to see them just disappear in front of them, it's got to be terrible, you know?
Well, David, where do residents of long-term care rank compared to, say, business owners? I mean, health professionals who advocate tough measures say, well, the government has to compensate people. But, you know, last week the Prime Minister said, hey, you know, like, this is not an infinite resource.
Well, it's true that there's not an infinite resource. And I think that if you want to say that in the larger society, even the shocking death rate among seniors in long-term care homes compared to creating the second Great Depression out of the 1930s, there are going to be certainly very agonizing trade-offs, and it's very, I don't want to sound like somebody who's glib or, you know, about this whole problem, and Peter's right, there's huge issues. All we're saying is, in the area in which you profess to be able to do something, and you've claimed that you're able to do something, and your only focus is, as a ministry, is on long-term care homes, what are you actually doing? It's quite reasonable to ask for that particular sector to get better performance than it's been getting. It's not reasonable to ask for that sector to solve the entire problem of society, for sure not. But it's very reasonable to say, to the extent that that's your topic, what are you doing with it? And right now, it's just not good enough.
Okay, we're basically out of time. Bill and Peter, 20 seconds each, starting with Peter.
Well, just to end on a hopeful note, the second vaccine, the Moderna vaccine, is showing promise in testing. So perhaps, you know, with all the doom and gloom, maybe, you know, we'll be saved by either the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine, and we can sort our way out of it through treatment rather than through shutdown.
Okay, well, a whole bunch of issues surrounding that as well. Bill Van Gorder, your 20 seconds.
I would ask your listeners, if they agree with the concern that we've expressed today, to go to carp.ca, sign the petition, give us your thoughts in the notes on how you're finding it's going, and let's make sure that we let the government know that we're not happy and something has to be done now.
Okay. Thank you so much to our Zoomer squad, Peter Mugridge, David Kravitz, and Bill Van Gorder. Thank you.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.